We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. We'd like to give a special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. And for more information about Perpetual Chess, you can go to PerpetualChessPod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. Before we introduce our guest this week, I wanted to give a shout out to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. Chessable is dropping new courses all the time to help you with any aspect of your game. I myself have been checking out the Ready Nimzowitsch Larsen Attack by FM Dalton Perrine and Grandmaster Yaroslav Zhero book. This is a great choice if you're looking for something solid with some hidden venom, but not too theoretical. It's a great choice if you're playing a lot of kids in tournaments, hypothetically speaking. So I've been playing that opening anyway, so super excited to check out the course. Eugene Perelstein has a new course on the Hyper Accelerated Dragon. Eugene has been developing the theory of this opening for as long as I can remember. I also wanted to give a quick shout out to Grandmaster Daniel King, who is coming soon to Perpetual Chess. Always a popular guest. He's going to help me preview the FIDE World Championship. But before then, on March 24th, he will be giving a masterclass with Chessable on using the outpost. So if you're interested in potentially taking Grandmaster King's class, then check out the show notes. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest for this week, who is one of my favorite modern authors. He has written a book called On the Origin of Good Moves, which traces the evolution of chess, one of my personal favorites. He also wrote Move First, Think Later, which was the ECF book of the year, and he is out with a new book called Ink War, which covers the first world championship match between Steinitz and Zukertort, and it's a lot of fun to read. I mean, it really takes you behind the scenes. These were some fascinating characters, and our guest is actually also a top Dutch player, but also an accomplished improver. He didn't start chess till the age of 12, reached great heights, has two GM norms to go along with his IM title. So we are pleased to welcome back to the show, IM Willy Hendricks.
Thank you, Ben, and nice to be back.
Yes, great to catch up. As is customary, I finished your book just in time, a couple of days before our interview. I've been greatly enjoying it. It's as we'll talk about in a few minutes, it's a little bit different than your prior books, a little bit more historic based, although it has some of your hallmark tools in writing as well. But first, Willie, let's talk about your chess, because when we last spoke, it was 2020. You had just finished a big chess project. And as we wrapped up, you said now that you were done with this book, you were hoping to play a bit more chess. I checked out your FIDE profile, and it looks like you're playing some league games. But I'm curious, from your perspective, what is going on with your chess?
Well, actually, not that much, unfortunately. I played a few league games, but that's all. I think, like a lot of players, the pandemic, of course, had an influence. And after that, well, I'm a bit in doubt what to do. I haven't played any tournaments before. I was used to play, say, 3 serious tournaments a year, or maybe 4. But and what keeps me back a bit is also that I have to do some serious work before I can enter a serious tournament arena. So so it's a bit not that much is happening. So only I've only played a few, well, one league game every month I play. And that's it for the moment. So if I want to serious start again playing tournaments, I'll have to do some serious work. Because even for me, I'm not an elite player who has to work really hard nowadays. But even at my level, some work has to be done, and I'm a bit how do you say that, trailing behind, lagging behind in this area.
Yeah, I can certainly relate to that, Willie. As we record this on March 9th, I'm heading to a tournament tonight, and uh-huh. I'm going to Alto in Charlotte, which is an adult-only tournament here. It will long since happen by the time this interview comes out, but I've been really busy lately. I'm working on a book, so my chess study has been an all-time low. But I wanted to play in this tournament. I wanted to meet the people in Charlotte. But I could tell you, the feeling of going to a tournament and feeling like you're not prepared is not a good one.
Yeah, yeah. So, so yeah, indeed. For me, it's I decide so not to go to the tournament
right
until I'm ready. So I wish you good luck with yeah, being so unprepared. But it's difficult. Some work has to be done, but I'm still in my mind. I still have the idea of re-entering some sort of serious chess.
Yeah, and going to a tournament unprepared, I do feel like it lets you build the skill of sort of forgiveness and disassociation, which as you get older and you know you're not playing for rent money, yeah, you're just playing to stay sharp and to enjoy yourself. It's an important skill to cultivate.
Yeah. Yes.
So Willie, you're a chess trainer, and obviously you've written some incredible books on the topic of chess learning. But one thing we didn't talk about so much in our last interview, we got into sort of the overall theses of your landmark books. But I was curious if you feel like through all of your writing, all of your research, and of course you're becoming a very strong player yourself, do you have an overall chess improvement philosophy?
Well, a basic idea of all my books is that chess quality is based in quantity, and that's not a very idea that it's so it's very averse to the idea of the, well, maybe you expected me to tell the big secret which I'm not the only one who says that the big secret is that there are no secrets at all, and I think that's also the way you can compare human thinking with the engine way of thinking. Both have in common that the quality that comes out is based on quantity, and so. You really have to work hard and do all those different things. And I And nowadays there are a lot of there's a lot of very good material to improve in chess, and of course you should choose the smartest ones. But I think everyone who wants to work hard, there's so much good material nowadays that I think everyone can get the most out of his or her talents. So
yeah, I think
maybe a bit disappointing as an overall philosophy. I can tell you a bit more about it because in some senses it's a bit contrary to some traditional ways of looking at chess improvement. But for example, just to add something, because otherwise my what I just said sounds a bit a bit poverish. How do you say that? For example, the idea of that you can improve by learning how to make plans. That's a very popular idea in chess improvement history, and a lot of books offer ways of how to make plans and study the characteristics of a position, and then make a plan on the basis of them. Whereas I think it's not about learning to make plans, but about learning a lot of plans. So that's a difference. And
that's an interesting distinction.
Like the way. And that's also in tactics. When you study tactics, it's much more usual to say to someone, you have to see and study all those different tactics. And I think likewise with plans, you simply have to learn all learn all those different plans, and instead of some kind of magical way of extracting those plans out of the study of the characteristics of a position. But so okay, more, maybe we'll...
So more of a top-down approach than a bottom-up in terms of coming up with plans?
Well, my approach is the bottom-up approach, I would say.
But it sounds like you're saying... Say you're studying a certain opening, you should learn the specific plans from the strong players that have played it before. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah.
Okay.
That there is no secret way of finding all those strategical ideas and maneuvers and plans from looking good at the characteristics of a position. That's the difference. So, and that's the quantity. Everybody agrees you have to a lot of quantity regarding tactics. You have to do all this work and get acquainted with all those different forms of tactics. And I think strategy plans, strategic maneuvers. It's just the same way. You have to take in all those different. Typical ways of playing and not bother with some kind of secret protocol to study the position and find the right plan.
And how would you recommend amateur players go about learning these plans?
Well, I think we discussed this before, that studying openings is a very good way to get acquainted with typical plans, and that also has the advantage of the direct feedback. You study an opening whatever way you study it, whatever source, you get acquainted with some ideas, you start playing on the internet. And you look back at your games, and maybe you start with a few plans in an opening, but because you're sure you will have that opening on the board in your games, it's very rewarding because you'll get direct feedback, and so that's a way to slowly build up your opening and your repertoire, and you'll meet new ideas. You start with very little. You start playing, and maybe on the basis of that, you got a position on the board, and you didn't know what to do next. Now maybe you can look up a few games with from strong players with that position, or you can look up in a book, or in a course you followed. So I think that. To take you the openings you play as the basis from which you build on, I think that's a very good idea to build up your strategical knowledge.
Great advice. Yeah, and as we mentioned in our last conversation, you really changed my thinking about that. I had been a bit dogmatically preaching that especially lower rated adult amateurs study too many openings. Now, that still may be true in some cases, but I think your broader point of the value that can be gained by studying openings, and as you say, studying structures and plans in particular, I've certainly come around to your school of thought there. And one more follow-up on this topic, Willie. These days, I mean, as you alluded to, there's so much to choose from. And in addition to studying plans, these days, like on Lee Chess, for example, you can look for tactics within your opening. You can filter their Puzzle Explorer for tactics from your opening. Is that a way that you would advocate studying as well?
I tried it a few times, but I think so. It looks very sensible. There's so much on this in this area developing so quickly, and I'm not an expert on that. I saw that Lee Chess function, but of course, in all other there's so much on in this area developing at the moment, and I don't keep track of it.
It's a lot.
I'm sure there are a lot of very useful functions and these tactics. In the earlier days there was opening books with tactics in this and that opening, but now this functions of course much quicker and better,
And let me ask you, Willie, so I know that you're a chess trainer. Last time we talked, you mentioned you do, or at least at the time, were doing some casual adult classes. But what is your day-to-day like? Are you doing one-on-one lessons? Are you doing group lessons? Are you working with top youth? Like, what is the majority of your chess teaching work entail?
I'm not doing that much training at the moment, but mostly it's group training. Adults and youth. But I'm not doing that much anymore, and I'm more into at the moment writing on chess. But that's my main occupation at the moment.
Excellent. Well, we are certainly glad that you're spending the time. I mean, something like this project on the Ink War, where you're sort of doing original research and tipping over sacred cows, I guess you could say. Like you're revealing sort of received wisdom that may be false, that's been passed down for generations. But before we dig into that, we should probably give a bigger picture view on the Ink War. So I think I might know the answer to this, but what was the beginnings of this project? So how did this idea to write about, and we should say it's about the Steinitz-Zuckerter first world championship match in the 19th century, but they're fascinating personalities, and I.M. Hendrix covers the whole build-up to the match. So what led to this project, Willie?
Well, it builds forth on my previous book, On the Origin of Good Moves, and in it, Zuckertort plays a small role. Zuckertort, you can say, is the tragic hero of my new book, but he also played a role in that earlier book. And I gave a lecture on that book for a Dutch chess club named after Zuckertort, the Zuckertort Amstelveen Chess Club. And then slowly I got the idea when preparing for that lecture that this match and the whole everything that went before it that led to the match that was a very nice way to tell the story of how modern chess developed. And also my second idea was not only to give a picture of how the birth of modern chess, but also I got the idea that it would be possible to tell it as an interesting, compelling story. Not really a thriller or a detective, but somehow a captivating story. That were the two ideas. So the themes that I discuss some of them I'd already addressed in my previous book, but it's also the telling the story, which was for me I hope I could get that done to make a compelling story out of it.
Yeah, which you definitely did. I'm always impressed that you're writing in English. You're writing in your second language, and you're a very very good writer. Greatly enjoyed it. I just want to give our listeners a few more facts. I always try to tell them like where they can get a book, what rating range. So number one, we should say Willie's book is available from New in Chess. New in Chess is also publishing my book, but I select who I interview independently, and obviously we'll be interviewing. I have interviews planned with authors from all publishers, and that will continue. But we should say Willie's book is available in Kindle. It's available on the New in Chess app, and obviously it's available in book form as well. We have a listener question. Oh, and in terms of rating range, I always like to give listeners a little guidance. That's one thing that I can say is a real benefit of your book. Number one, a wide range of chess fans can appreciate it. There's tons of diagrams, the explanations are good. So, I mean, if you're rated 1200, some of the chess may go over your head, but you will have no problem reading the book and following the explanations for the puzzles presented. And obviously, as you move up the rating scale, you can enjoy the book all the more. Now, we've got a listener question. Oh, and last thing to add is this is a book that can be read without a chess set, I would say. I read it on Kindle and never took out a set. And I may have missed a few things here and there, a few details I would have enjoyed more. But generally, it's a good chess bedside reading. So question about the context of the match, since this is from Roy Lopes, supporter of the podcast. Thank you for submitting the question and for supporting the podcast, Roy. And he goes straight to sort of what you build up to, the main event, which again is the World Championship, excuse me, between Zukertat and Steinitz. So Roy writes, he says, in 1886, Zukertat was leading 4-1 after just 5 games, but eventually lost the match. So his first question is, did you find any clues that explain such a turn of events, but apart from the tenacity of Steinitz? And his second question is, in your opinion, what are the most innovative contributions of Zukertat to modern chess?
That are two good questions. One point that played probably an important role in the match was Zukertat's health situation. He had health problems during all his life, and the match was organized in 3 different cities. It started in New York, and Zukertat was doing very well. When they left New York, he was 4-1 leading. Then they went to New Orleans, that was the second city, and they ended in St. Louis, or the other way around. I'm not that strong in the, but anyway, in this second part, he already got some health problems, but he claimed, especially in the last part, he got really sick. He Zuckertort himself said he had malaria, and at the end he completely collapsed. I personally think Steinitz was the stronger player, anyhow, but quite likely his poor health did Zuckertort much harm. And as we all know, he only lived 2 years after the match, and then he died of problems with his heart and vascular problems he had. So I make the somewhat typical remark that Zuckertort proved more or less by the way he died that indeed his health did play a role in that match, because Steinitz did try to downplay that a little bit, which is understandable, because it's if you have won a world champion match, and nobody wants to hear that it's because the opponent wasn't in good shape. So that's an answer to the first question. But I think Steinitz was the stronger player, but it's clear that Zuckertort collapsed. The second question was what.
The most innovative contributions of Zuckertort to my
Zuckertort in his whole life. Yeah, well, a major topic in my book is, of course, the what in the subtitle is I call Romanticism versus modernity, and the bigger story of how modern chess came into being. There is this mythological story that Steinitz either discovered or invented modern positional chess, and in these accounts of chess history, Zuckertort is put in the opposing role. He's the anti-hero who has to represent the old attacking school, the romantic chess, which you can. Which is characterized by the idea of attack at all costs. That's the basic.
That's romanticism.
Caricature of romantic chess, and that story is completely false, I would say, on all accounts, and especially it's especially very sad for Zuckertort, who wanted to be a modern chess player himself. So he didn't look at him at all as being a representative of the old attacking school. And I think that's completely correct. Zuckertort was a modern player. And for example, he at that time, the great majority of games were open games, so e4, e5. And Zuckertort experimented a lot with d4 openings, or starting with knight f3 or sometimes e3, but basically d4 openings. And then he also tried to play on the queen side. There are quite a few games with Zuckertort playing on the queen side, and he had his own special plan with trying to play c5 and then have a pawn avalanche on the queen side. That was a very typical strategy Zuckertort often tried, and that's of course a very modern strategy. If you look at the textbooks, the idea of a pawn majority on the queen side, that plays an important role today, not so much as in the earlier days, but if you look at those old manuals on chess strategy, this idea of the pawn majority on the queen side, that's really a very big theme. And Zuckertort more or less was one of the first players who regularly demonstrated that. So that's one thing I think
Zuckertort
has left us, and which is typical modern idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to learn from both players, but you certainly make a convincing case that, as you say in the book, as the saying goes, history is written by the winners, and the fact that Steinitz won the match definitely seems to have impacted the way that the story of the development of of chess gets told. Now, you single out, I believe, both in on The Origin of Good Moves and in this book, you mention Lasker's Manual of Chess in particular and Lasker's writing in general as having sort of an outsized influence on how chess history has been told in subsequent years. Willie, what led you to that observation? How did you manage to put that piece of the puzzle in place?
Well, that's a difficult question. First of all, to explain it a little bit, Lasker was, of course, a tremendous player, and he also excelled in a lot of other fields. But I think his views on chess history are really, have brought a complete false picture into the world. And Lasker is not the only one who was, but he is my main culprit in this case. And later on, I think Euwe has contributed a lot, and also Reti had some influence. But I guess that Lasker is the main man who brought this idea of in the world that Steinitz was the great inventor of positional chess, and that before Steinitz they played some kind of silly attacking chess with which was purely based on intuition and whatever came at them in the moment at the moment that was. That was the way they played, a very primitive way of playing, and I think that Lasker is the main the main culprit here, and it is difficult why he chose that, and there has been written a few things about it, but Steinitz himself already was of course a big advocate of his own theories and of his status. I mentioned in the book, and that's a very important point to understand this period of chess history, is that these people had to fight very hard for their reputations because there were few tournaments, rating didn't exist yet. So if you were one of the strongest or maybe the strongest player of the moment, you had to fight for that yourself, which is nowadays that is completely unthinkable. Nobody will doubt who is the best. And if I claim that I have some chances against the Carlsen, you would laugh at me,
right?
Completely justified. So already Steinitz was. And Steinitz had also great ambitions. So he constantly talked about his new school, the modern school, he said. And later on, Lasker made something very different of it. Difficult part of the story. But Steinitz had his great claims, and Lasker made something very different out of that. But surely, for Lasker, Steinitz was the great hero. And that fitted in also very well with Lasker's own philosophy, because Lasker also had ambitions in philosophy. He wrote several books on philosophy, and somehow Steinitz fitted in very well with Lasker's own ideas. So if you read Lasker, I think you cannot take it very seriously, but somehow everyone has taken Lasker very seriously. And what I would say is almost a fairy tale, if you read Lasker, that has become mainstream chess history. So that's what I try to describe in this book. But how that exactly went, I'm not completely sure. But that's my educated guess, that Lasker has been for the largest part responsible for the way we look at history. And for Zukertort, that was very sad, because Lasker had Steinitz, who was his hero, and so it was very nice for Lasker's story that Zukertort could take the other role, the role of the
The villain, yeah.
That Zukertort would represent the old-fashioned chess that Stein needs to put an end to. For Zukertort, that was for Zukertort's reputation. Lasker was really the.
Okay. Yeah, I read Lasker's Manual of Chess, but funny you should mention Richard Reddy. I've also mentioned many times on the pod, Masters of the Chessboard was a formative book for me by Reddy as well, and I certainly remember him teaching in that book that Steinitz invented positional chess. So it's interesting, and of course, when you think about it, not surprising to understand that things are more nuanced than that. But I and many others, of course, definitely. Were influenced by those writings. Now, we should talk a bit about the title, because you mentioned, of course, that these guys had to be advocates for themselves. And one thing that's striking through the book is just how difficult their lives are compared to modern chess professionals. Perhaps we'll return to that. But first, Willie, it would probably be helpful for listeners if you explain the idea behind the title, The Ink War.
Yes, The Ink War, yeah. And some say The Ink Wars. This specific name is used for a specific episode, mostly when between Zukertort and Steinitz, the fighting became really very intense, and it was mainly fighting on paper, so fighting in chess columns and chess magazines. But for me, it very well captures the overall theme of my book. And that's what you just said, that people had to fight very hard for their reputation and for who is the best player, but also for their ideas. And we just mentioned Steinitz had very clear ideas, and he saw himself as the spokesman or the inventor of a new modern playing style. So both ideas and who was the strongest. And because there was no rating, no engines, which is also very important. So they could also discuss at length positions or moves because there were no there was no engine who could give the final verdict. And that's actually what I very much like about this period in chess, that those people had the opportunity to make war with each other about on ideas and on moves and openings and games. Nowadays there's so little discussion possible because the engine speaks, gives the final verdict, and it's so that's a bit the lost world part of my book. I'm looking back with some melancholy feelings about a part of chess culture that has gone away. But to answer your question about the Ink War, at some point Zukertort played a match against Blackburn. Zukertort won that match. And Steinitz, who had a famous chess column in a newspaper, The Field, he commented upon all those games. And, Zukertort had at the time his own magazine, The Chess Monthly. And Zukertort reacted on those analyses by Steinitz. And maybe Zukertort was a bit, he had won that match, maybe he was becoming a bit more optimistic or self-assured. Anyway, he criticized Steinitz a few times, and a bit too much according to Steinitz. So Steinitz sent a letter to Zukertort's magazine complaining about the way Zukertort treated his analysis in his magazine. And that was that letter from Steinitz was six pages at least, because one of the problems Steinitz had is he could not how do you say that? He could not limit himself. So if Steinitz had some complaints, he always needed to address every single point he disagreed with. So in reaction to the letter of Steinitz, Zukertort in his magazine wrote a piece, and that was even more voluminous, and he made also some kind of contest out of it, and the big letters on the front were the Chess Monthly versus the Field, and according to Zukertort, the final score was 10-1 in his own advantage. So he made some kind of an analytical contest out of it, and he said, "Well, he claimed to have proven that he was right in almost all cases." And so he made a bit of fool of Steinitz, and then really war broke loose. And so Steinitz then reacted, but not anymore in the Chess Monthly. Steinitz rightly decided, well, there I have nothing to win anymore. So he reacted in another chess magazine. And that again was an enormous... It took him, I think, 7 numbers of that magazine to react on all Zukertort's claims. But what he also did was he challenged Zukertort for a match. At first he said he challenged Zukertort and Hoffer. Hoffer was the co-editor of the Chess Monthly. He said, "I play you both in a match together, and I give you some points in advance if you want." But Steinitz was so enraged that he wanted to settle things in a match. That match didn't take place directly, but finally that was the beginning of the negotiations for what finally would become the first match for the World Championship. So in this episode, but also because it's a very nice metaphor for the complete book and for the complete period in which people really could struggle with each other about ideas and moves and openings and about the question who is the best.
Yeah, it's fascinating. These days, of course, it seems like they would be like fierce Twitter rivals. They would have been going back and forth. But it's hard to project forward because, as you say, so much of it was dictated by the circumstances where they felt that they had to be advocates for their own skills and their own ideas. And one thing I really enjoyed about the book, in addition to sort of the big story, is the little mini mysteries that crop up, the sort of historical questions that you're not sure about. For example, whether Blackburn had to illegitimate children. And then there's this famous game, Grimshaw and Steinitz, which I recommend listeners, you might be familiar with it when you see it, but it's one of these games that we're not sure if it actually happened. So could you describe a bit about the game, but also like what your research uncovered about the historical context of this miniature where Steinitz loses that may or may not have happened?
Yeah, yeah. First, a minor point. Zukertort was the one who might have had two children.
Oh, sorry. But, sorry, I meant Zukertort. Go ahead.
That's a very difficult story about this game Grimshaw Steinitz. And the funny thing about this in the chess base mega base, there's only one game of Grimshaw beating Steinitz in 16 moves. So I make the remark that for one game record, that's what more do you want? Beating the world number one in the 16 moves or something like that. But Steinitz claimed the game was never played, that it was a fake game and that was made up to make a fool of himself. And Steinitz was at the time living in London, and Steinitz was a very special character who easily made enemies. And so at the time, he Also in the period that the conflict with Zukertort played up, he had made a lot of enemies in London. And so he thought that this was a trick played upon him by his enemies, this game, that somehow they invented the game. Although Steinitz admitted there had been a game between him and Grimshaw, but he claimed that was a completely different game. Huh. And well, I present it in my book as kind of conspiracy story, and maybe it was a conspiracy. There are different opinions on it. I think and the Saltus thinks that it was a genuine game. He has a book, David versus Goliath, in which Saltus says, well, it really took place, and Steinitz was so embarrassed by that game that he later tried to deny it really happened. But I think Saltus says something like, well, eventually witnesses stepped forward and say, yes, this was the game played. But those witnesses are not, I don't think they are that trustworthy. So it's really, very funny story, but it fits in very nicely in my overall story because of, well, it nicely illustrates how Steinitz in his London years had to fight with all those enemies. And that was also because I mentioned those people had to fight for their reputation and their ideas. But Steinitz generally fought very hard, and he made a lot of enemies, and he was also a bit arrogant figure. And so in his struggle for fighting for his status, he went a bit far, and that's why he so easily made enemies. And Zukertort was better liked in the London chess circles. Both were, of course, immigrants of Jewish origin who came from Central Europe to London, so they already had a difficult time there, and they were also professionals, which wasn't which made their life difficult as well. But well, this story very well illustrates how difficult Steinitz had it in London. But partly that was because it was his own fault, I think. So even if it is true that they tried to play a trick on him, well, he somehow deserved it because he made so many enemies that they did want to play this trick on him. But maybe the game is real. I leave it in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, it's more fun not to know, in a sense. And to your point about Steinitz's personality, it is fascinating. Like, I don't know if enjoyed is the right word, because at some point in the book, you have like a two-page excerpt of Steinitz like addressing an argument point by point. And as you said earlier, like, he just won't let it go. Like, he just goes in such excruciating detail that it's painful to read, but it does give you appreciation for what their lives were like, and as you say, why Steinitz was not the most popular chess player at the time.
Yeah.
So we've got another listener question, Willie, on the topic of the book. This one is from Eiko Hadari, longtime friend and supporter of the pod, and he says, first of all, I wanted to say that I'm also one of the big fans of your writings and research. Your style is sweet and fun to read. Your research is admirable. And your first book was also highly popular in Iran. Eiko is Iranian, although he lives in the Bay Area. He's in California. He says, I've also been a big fan of Zukertort and read the books by Jimmy Adams. Happy to see that you went into that much detail about the match with Steinitz. And his question is, A, if you know what your next project would be, and B, since he lives in San Francisco, which has one of the largest libraries of chess books in the United States, if you ever need help researching a topic, he's happy to access those books for you. And I can put you guys in touch if needed. But do you know what your next project will be, Willie?
Well, let me first answer that. I'm very happy to hear, of course, that even in Iran, my books are popular, that I haven't heard that before. So thank you very much. And also thank you for offering your help. Well, I have a few ideas about my next book. Well, last time I was in your show, I said something about adult improvement.
Yeah.
And that's still on my mind, but I don't think that will be my next book. But I have several ideas. Also a book in a bit in the style of this book, my last book, but a bit slightly more modern history, with maybe people like Nimzowitsch and Tarash.
Okay.
I'm thinking about, but and I'm also thinking about writing a book from a philosophy of science perspective, with several topics which would be also have some historical part. But those are ideas I have at the moment.
Okay, but you haven't started anything yet. It sounds like
I'm started reading.
Okay, excellent.
That's the first part.
And how do you get your hands on all of the books you need to read?
Oh, well, that's rather difficult because I haven't got that big a library myself. I have some friends who have more books than I have. And fortunately, nowadays, a lot is available on internet. So, for example, for my last book, I couldn't have written that without everything that is available on the internet because... especially all those old magazines, quite a few of them are available. So for that, for the Inquirer, I have worked through a lot of chess magazines, really enormous amounts of a lot of almost everything you cannot use, but now and then you find something that fits in very nicely. But for that, you have to work through really a lot of those magazines. Hadn't it been for the internet, I couldn't have written such a book because, I unfortunately don't have a big library with all those beautiful old books and magazines.
Yeah, I don't either, unfortunately. I have my share, but definitely one always wants more. And Willie, I don't think we actually talked in our prior interview about your favorite chess books. I'm curious, as someone who's so well steeped in chess literature, if you have any personal favorites.
Well, some of the old books, maybe, although they are not that although I wouldn't recommend them for studying chess now, but for example, Kotov, Think Like a Grandmaster, is for several reasons still a classic, although I disagree with almost everything that's said in it.
Right.
I think it's still a classic book. Also, Tarash, Meine 300 Schachpartien, My 300 Games of Chess, which is, that's a classic, and I think it's still very good good read. A bit more modern, Jean Nunn, Secrets of Practical Chess, I liked a lot, and also a book, a bit typical book, Hans Kmoch, Kunst der Bauernführung, that has been translated into English, but I don't know the English title.
Is that Pawn Power or a different
book? Yeah, The Art of Pawn Power or something like that.
Okay.
Has been really influential, although I by now don't have much faith in the project he is trying to get done in that book, but still a fascinating book. So that are just a few books.
Okay. I have to tell you, Willie, I'm on the record as a Pawn Power hater. I tried to read it, and I read it as a kid. Or actually, I didn't read it. Mike Shahadi, who's a FIDE master and was occasionally presenting lessons for me and international master Greg Shahadi, actually showed us chapters from it when I was a kid. But I tried to revisit it with a friend of the podcast, Neil Bruce, and we both found it quite boring, I have to admit. But
yeah,
it holds its place in history.
Yeah, but it was a book that had a big influence on me back then. And later I realized this idea of this ambitious idea of all those different structures with special names. It didn't really work out, but okay, that's one. But it had some influence, and that's also with the Code of Books and some other books, like you mentioned, the Reti books. They're very important, influential books. Although we nowadays, if you want to become a better chess player, I would not advise. I wouldn't advise to read them. But
yeah, and are you keeping up with the modern chess books?
Not really. Well, today there are so many chess books are being published every year. Too many, I would say. And it's very difficult to keep track of all of them. So I'm not well versed in the latest chess books.
Okay. And what about, do you have a favorite player, Willie, of all time?
No.
Favorite modern player?
No, not really. No.
Very, you're very impartial. You're, I guess it helps
yeah.
you out. And Willie, one other topic we didn't touch on. I was checking out your OTB career. I saw that obviously being a top Dutch player who's played in Vijkan Zee and, many of the top tournaments over there. You've gotten to play Jan Timman, of course, Sokolov, a lot of the top Dutch players, Erwin Lamy. Do you have a favorite memory from your own competitive career?
Well, against those strong guys, I generally did very poor. So not against them anyway. But well, I have some. I have a small database with games and game fragments that I cherish. And there is a lot of moments, games in them, but they are not against very famous players. But I think that was an advice Jesper Hall. I guess you know him.
Yeah, Swedish trainer,
right?
He had
this advice to younger players: make a database with games and fragments titled something like "My Most Beautiful Games or Fragments," and that's what I have done. I started with that some years ago, and everything I'm really proud on, I put in that database. I think it's very good advice for everyone. Recently, I had in a training group, I mentioned this, and I also asked them give me your most beautiful combination you ever played, or the tactical fragment that you think was really special. And a lot of players can't come up with something in that case because, they never kept something. We play so many games, and also, unfortunately, most of them are not very good, and some of them are simply terrible. But now and then, so we do something we really are satisfied with. So I think it's a good idea to put that in a special database, and so I have my special moments. But unfortunately, as I said, not against the big guys. I had always trouble with them. I against all those players you mentioned, I made a few draws, but lost the great majority.
Certainly understandable. Those guys are incredible chess players.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you're very strong in your own right. I like the. Sorry, go ahead.
I once won a game against Jordan van Vreest, and it was a very nice game, but I have to admit he was still very very young
yeah.
at the moment.
I would have guessed. Yeah, you got to play these champs when they're young.
Yeah, that's strong advice.
Yeah, and I do like the idea of sort of celebrating your wins, because anyone who plays a lot over the board, you're certainly going to have your losses that sting, and it's easy to lose confidence, so it is nice. I like Jesper Hall's idea of collecting your best moments, no matter mm-hmm. how modest they may be in the big picture of yeah. chess. Now, yeah, Willie, before this has been great, but before we let you go, we have one more listener question, and this one is from a fellow chess trainer, David Lazarus, and he's just curious if you count points when you're evaluating a chess position, like with the material bishops and knights being worth three and rooks being worth five, and maybe you could talk a little generally also about evaluating positions, because I feel like it's being discussed more in the chess discourse recently.
Yeah, I saw there was a book which I haven't read on specifically on evaluating.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big topic because, as I told you before, this traditional scheme of evaluating position, selecting candidate moves, and then start the some kind of thought process that should select the best move. That's not my model. My first book is titled Move First, Think Later, and that already indicates that this order, the order in our thinking process is one of the major themes of that book. So actually, I don't think we think about positions like that, like evaluating and then find out the general plan and then fill that in with moves. So I think, and that goes, of course, unconscious. You very quickly get an idea of what the position is about. And then already also very quickly moves come into your mind. And starting to work with that move, with those moves, help you to evaluate the position. So it's much more circular than that there is a specific order wherein you start with evaluating. Of course, there's a difference between positions you see in a book you are completely new to and positions in your own games which you have built up yourself. So if you're playing a game, you already have an idea about what the position is about. So this strange idea in, for example, Kotov, who I mentioned, this idea that at some points in the game you should take a good look, pause for some time and look at all those characteristics and then make a big plan. Kotov was, of course, the communist ideology, so he liked to make big plans and then smaller plans, and finally the best move comes rolling out. But that's that traditional idea I do not share at all. So I think if a chess player looks at the position, it goes really fast and he recognizes certain things and directly connected with that are certain moves that capture your attention and you start working with that. So I like to say that what works is so important for the right evaluation that you cannot separate them. So you cannot. So it all happens at the same time. So I'm not about some kind of conscious evaluation. I never do actually.
Interesting.
I see. I guess almost all players, on the basis of what they already know, they look at the position and they recognize in a split second what they think it is about, and that goes for beginning players as well as very strong players. You have a certain amount of knowledge, you look at the position, you've got an idea what it is more or less about, or is it on that side, or is it happening on the green side, or and for example you quickly think, well, maybe I can do something against this king. And you start, of course, you start looking at moves, and then maybe you quickly come to the conclusion, well, it's not that much as I hoped for. So slowly, circular is maybe not the right term, but it's not that clean process which starts with evaluating and ends with moves rolling out. So do I evaluate the position? That's a difficult question. I'm not sure if I ever do that in the traditional way. But As yeah, if you can look at the position and don't see moves. If you look at the position, you of course you directly see moves because they're intrinsically connected elements of a position and effective moves. They are so much connected that you can't look at the position without directly spotting interesting moves.
Yeah, and
okay,
as you
that
say,
was a long answer, but still not only a very partial answer.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does answer his question. Basically, your answer is no, you don't think about chess that way. And if David hasn't read Move First, Think Later, and actually, I mean, anyone listening, it's well worth a read. I as I mentioned in our previous interview, you convince me of that way of thought, but even if someone reads it and doesn't necessarily agree with your thesis, I think it's good to challenge your assumptions, and you certainly make some compelling points in it. So, Willie, this has been fascinating as always. I always enjoy and learn from speaking with you. Before we say our goodbyes, do you have anything else to add?
Well, yes, one small thing. I hoped you would ask what I expected you maybe to ask for, because I just wrote a book about the first world championship match in history. And I thought maybe you're going to ask me if I don't regret it a bit that this beautiful tradition we have with this world championships, that it somehow is going in the wrong direction. And I recently heard, listened to a podcast with a very interesting podcast with Howard Burton. Uh-huh. And he said something like, well, if those world championships are going to disappear, well, that's not that bad a thing. So I thought maybe you're going to bring that up, because it's well, modern chess is, the developments are going so quickly nowadays, but I do think that's a bit, we have this beautiful history. Chess history in general is very interesting, but the all those world championships, they are an important part of our history. And also beyond chess, the chess domain, they are important, like Fischer-Spassky, and well, it's such a beautiful part of chess history. And I happened to write a book about the start of this beautiful tradition, and now we're at the point that people are discussing we're not losing that much if it stops, or and we have the I understand Magnus Carlsen has some good reasons not to defend this title, but still I think it's a pity that he doesn't. I don't want to say anything negative about his reasons. He has his reasons, but still that it's such a beautiful tradition. It's such a rich chess tradition that... Yeah. Well, anyway, I thought you might bring it up.
No,
but
you raise
maybe
an excellent
point. Maybe you have your
own
thoughts about it. But
yeah, no, and you've got plenty of company who feels that way. And I'm somewhere in the middle. I mean, as I mentioned with Howard, my problem is I sort of feel like it's an unstoppable tide. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, Magnus being the prime example of someone who no longer feels like it's worth, as Howard said, the time invested. Mm-hmm. But even Fabiano Caruana on the C-Squared podcast, of course, he's speaking openly about how much, to be frank, how much easier and more relaxing it is to play online, to play faster time controls. And there is a part of me that's sad about it, but it's more to me, like as Howard mentioned, if you look at other sports, they're constantly changing the rules, they're constantly tweaking formats. And to me, it's sort of happening whether we like it or not. So mm-hmm. I feel like it's okay to be sad, but there's not much we can do about it.
No, I think I agree with that. But still, compared to other sports, I think we have especially a very rich tradition, which I cannot think of. Well, I cannot think of another sport that has such a rich tradition, and we were one of the first sports that that had a world champion. So,
I see your point. And also, let me ask you from this perspective. You know, as we record this again, the world championship between Nepomniachtchi and Ding Liren is about a month away. I'm preparing to cover it. I'll be doing a preview episode that may even come out before this one. We'll see about that. But I have to admit, from a personal standpoint, as a chess fan, I'm having a hard time getting as excited as I would for a normal match. I mean, if Magnus were involved and if I felt like it determined the best player. Do you feel that way as well, Willie?
Yes, sure.
Yeah.
Okay, I think one of the problems, of course, is that Magnus is so strong, so incredibly strong, that that the gap between him and all the rest is maybe, yeah, is unfortunately, is it is that big that he doesn't feel compelled to defend his title. But indeed, it's... It's different without Magnus.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Well,
but I cannot. I cannot say to Magnus from look at our rich tradition. You have to. I don't think he has to. But it's as you say. It's the way it goes.
Yeah, I mean, and no one appreciates chess history more than Magnus. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, he's so well read, and you know. Devouring the books about Soviet chess history, mm-hmm. and so for him to have made that decision definitely speaks volumes.
But it's
you know, it's not a black and white issue for sure. I'm part of me is sad about it as well. But when I look at it through the lens of this current match, it definitely highlights why I feel like we can't put the genie back in the bottle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, Willie, always fantastic to catch up with you. The book is called Ink War. Again, highly recommend it for listeners. And if you're still listening and you're more interested in chess improvement and you have not read Willie's prior books, those are fantastic for chess improvement. But stuff like uncovering these elements of chess history that have been misrepresented and just telling these people's stories. I mean, I learned so much and I really appreciate that you put so much work into these books.
Thank you, Ben.
My pleasure. And whatever your next project is, I hope we can discuss it whenever it sees the light of day, Willie, as this one did. It may take me a while to read it, but I will eventually, and we'll gladly discuss it with you when the time comes.
I'll promise you I'll make a bit shorter book the next time, Ben.
Sounds good. No pressure. I will enjoy it however long. I just might need some help with other work and household chores so I can read it sooner. But mm-hmm. but thank you, Willie. Appreciate it as always.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. First and foremost to our producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. Got to thank the Patreon subs. Perpetual Chess would not be possible without you all. Be sure to follow us on your social media of choice. I'm at BennyFischel1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram. You can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group and continue the conversation with interview subjects. To email me, it's ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And be sure that you are sub to the Perpetual Chess Link Fest. It is a Substack newsletter that you can Google to find. Every week, I send out the best chess news stories that I have read the prior week, including lots of good chess improvement advice. So that should be everything. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.